right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump says he has instructed his representatives not to sign the communique. By all seven leaders attending the G7 summit in Canada Friday and Saturday, citing statements by Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau after he left. Trudeau closed the annual G7 summit in Canada Saturday by refusing to budge on positions that place him at odds with President Trump, particularly new tariffs on steel and aluminum that have irritated both Canada and the European Union. He said in closing remarks that Canada will proceed with retaliatory measures on U.S. goods as early as July 1st.
We do not want to harm American workers. We do not want to harm trade between Canada and the United States. But the administration's choice to impose illegal and unacceptable tariffs, illegitimate and unacceptable tariffs to Canadian steel workers and auto workers and on the Canadian economy must be met with an equivalent response.
But White House trade advisor Peter Navarro says on Fox News Sunday, President Trump did Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau a courtesy by attending the summit.
He did him a favor, and he was even willing to sign that socialist communique. And what did Trudeau do? As soon as the plane took off from Canadian airspace, Trudeau stuck our president in the back. That will not stand.
British Prime Minister Theresa May echoed Trudeau pledging to retaliate for tariffs on EU goods. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is holding its first summit since India and Pakistan and joined the bloc, which is widely seen by observers as a means for blocking American influence in Central Asia. The summit is being held in eastern Chinese coastal city. Political analysts see the Chinese leader Xi Jinping's statements as a direct statement toward the U.S. This is VOA News. It is no accident that Singapore was chosen to host the historic summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. One big reason is that the city is extremely safe and tightly controlled. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Singapore.
Singapore fashions itself as the world's first smart nation, and it's easy to see why. This is a hyper-connected country. A recent poll suggests Singaporeans spend almost 13 hours a day on their gadgets. There are cameras everywhere here, big ones. And of course, that's not necessarily unusual. But in Singapore, the government can conduct surveillance. Activists like Jolovan Wham, one of the Singapore government's most prominent critics.
If you're an activist in Singapore, you have to make, or politician, you have to make the assumption that everything that you say, everything that you do, and even emails, conversations with friends, these are things that they have access to.
Wham was charged last year for organizing unauthorized protests. Yeah. Bill Gallo, VOA News. Singapore.
A newly released survey finds 77% of Israeli Jews approve of U.S. President Donald Trump's handling of U.S.-Israel relations, while only 44% of American Jews do. The information released Sunday ahead of the opening of the AGC Global Forum in Jerusalem reveals sharp differences between U.S. and Israeli Jews on several topics. On the U.S. decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move its embassy there, 85% of Israeli Jews compared with 46% of U.S. Jews support the move. More than two-thirds of Israeli Jews, 68%, say it is not appropriate for American Jews to attempt to influence Israeli policy. The special counsel investigating Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election escalated the pressure on President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, bringing additional charges against him and a longtime associate for attempting to tamper with potential witnesses. The new charges accuse Manafort and Konstantin Kilmanik of intentionally attempting to corruptly persuade two unidentified people with intent to influence, delay, and prevent their testimony. The contacts took place between February and April of this year. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced Saturday that nearly $3 billion in pledges have been raised to help fund the education of vulnerable girls and women around the world. Canada will contribute $300 million to the campaign. Germany, Japan, Britain, and the World Bank are among the additional supporters. The Prime Minister made the announcement on the last day of the G7 summit. Women's groups that had met with Trudeau on the sidelines of the summit welcomed the news of the generous pledges that exceeded the group's expectations. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Every Nigerian who was alive on June 12, 1993, and even those who were born after June 12, 1993, have the utmost respect for Chief MK Abiola.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari honors Chief Moshood Abiola.
There is no comeback for Joyce Banda.
It's a significant influence or affect the 2019 election. She cannot become president again.
Malawian Vice President Saulos Chilima resigns from the ruling Democratic People's Party, DPP.
Mnangagwa does not have the capacity and the political will to endanger the political future by making any structural adjustments to the political processes. So it is within the DNA of ZANU-PF to cheat in the elections, and it's not going to change that.
And Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa promises to reform internal systems of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says the declaration of June 12 as the new date for the celebration of the country's Democracy Day is regrettable and unfortunate. This after President Buhari also awarded Chief Moshood Abiola with the Grand Commander of the Federal Republic posthumously, a title reserved exclusively for a Nigerian head of state. Abiola was adjudged to have won the 1993 presidential election, which was annulled by military ruler General Ibrahim Babangida. His children and ruling party supporters say the award is well deserved and the right thing to do for a Nigerian philanthropist who fought for the country's democracy. For more reaction, I reach Kola Ologbodiyan, spokesman for the opposition PDP.
As a country, you know that Nigeria has different landmark dates. For instance, October 4, 1960, was our Independence Day. I will celebrate it. But on June 12, 1993, we had a presidential election that was annulled by the military under General Sani Abacha, and Sani Abacha became the head of state. And since that June 12, 1993 election, Nigerians consider that election as the triumph of democracy over dictatorship. The election was also adjudged as the fairest, freest, and the most credible in our national history. It is instructive to say that the PDP has no problem with any date adopted by Nigerians as a day to celebrate democracy.
The president also, in announcing the new date, granted the commander of the Federal Republic reserved exclusively for Nigeria's president to Chief Moshood Abiola, who was adjudged to have won the election at that time. Some people are saying that the PDP seemed to be displeased with the political masterstroke of the president, and that is why it is against this measure as a political party. How do you respond to that?
The PDP has no problem with any honor done unto the memory of Chief MK Abiola. But what is important to us in the PDP, as well as to the majority of Nigerians, is the observance of democratic ethos and norms, respect for our constitution and rule of law, the conduct of free and fair elections, the personal freedom of citizens, obedience to the principles of separation of power, respect for media, freedom of speech, which are all the reasons that Abiola fights. And as you can see, a regular with us in Nigeria, all these are being respected under President Muhammadu Buhari. And our position is that if you are driving our country, if you are driving our nation towards anarchy, you cannot, in another address, be honoring the memory of Chief Moshood Abiola.
Now, but Chief Kola, what Nigerians are saying is that Boko Haram
has been reduced to the barest minimum, and that Nigerians are enjoying the full benefits of democracy, free speech, and the rule of law. Nobody is being harassed or tarnished. The fight against corruption is going on unabated, and those who have stolen public funds will be dealt with in accordance with the law. What is wrong with that?
That is not correct. Whoever is saying that, perhaps was on me, on Nigerian part of the earth, as we speak, the war against corruption is a fight against perceived enemies. What the PDP is against is the current narrowing of the political space, the trampling of citizens' rights and personal freedom, as well as executive high-handedness. Anybody who is telling you that Boko Haram has been reduced to the barest is misstating the facts. Boko Haram has not been reduced to the barest, and as a matter of fact, there is a new form of killing in our country, which is being perpetrated by invaders who go into communities, go into churches, and are killing people. And the government is looking helpless in that circumstance.
Some APC supporters have dismissed your suggestion that what President Muhammad Buhari did by announcing and awarding this special award to the deceased Moshood Obiola as a political desperation is an indication that the PDP is ill prepared to acknowledge the fact that credit must be given to who deserves it.
That is not correct. Every Nigerian who was alive on June 12, 1993, and even those who were born after June 12, 1993, have the utmost respect for Chief MK Abiola. And the majority of Nigerians believe that the memory of Chief MK Abiola must be honored. Therefore, what we are saying in the People's Democratic Party is that you do not negate the spirit and MK Abiola lived for during his lifetime, and you turn around another bed and say you are honoring the memory.
Kola Ologbodinyan is the spokesman for the Nigerian opposition PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Malawian Vice President Saulos Chilima has resigned from the ruling Democratic People's Party, or DPP. His resignation came after he publicly accused President Arthur Mutharika's government of corruption. Local media reports say his decision to quit has exposed a rift in the ruling party, which has come under criticisms for alleged corruption. It followed reports that some supporters of the ruling party want the vice president to replace incumbent President Mutharika ahead of next year's general election. For analysis, I read Vincent Kondui, a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
What comes out very, very clearly is that the vice president is very, very indecisive. Secondly, he's not very sure of what he wants to do, whether to stand in 2019 as a presidential candidate or not. And thirdly, one might be tempted to think that he is stuck in the corporate world where he's coming from and does not show significant qualities of someone who wants to assume political leadership. The reason is that the whole nation was at a standstill, waiting for him to speak out his mind in relation to the 2019 elections. And at that moment, when he was supposed to rise to the occasion, he did not outlay his vision for the country. He did not explain why Malawians should rally behind him.
Do you think President Arthur Peter Mutharika, who chose him above everyone else to run with him, they won an election and all that? Some people are suggesting that he might have miscalculated by choosing him instead of choosing a seasoned politician to run with.
As a strategy, I think the strategy was very good because the Malawi needed a political leadership that demonstrated a sense of renewal, a kind of new approach to politics than what we had seen. So in choosing him to be the vice president in 2014. It was a very good political strategy that brought in a number of voter constituencies which could have not have voted for DPP. So the appointment of the vice president in 2014, for me, was a very good strategy. But in terms of delivery, to deliver as a team, I think there are two incompatible people who, I can say, it was just a marriage of convenience.
There are suggestions that the criticisms of the government, his decision to quit the party, talking about the vice president, Silas Chilima, that gives the biggest opposition party ammunition to use it against Peter Atta Mutharika in next year's election, which they said also could give Dr. Joyce Banda the leeway to significantly challenge and possibly win next year's presidential election. What's your take?
For Joyce Banda, trust me, it is a non-starter. There is no comeback for Joyce Banda to significantly influence or affect the 2019 election. She cannot become president again. As for the Malawi Congress Party gaining momentum from the vice president condemning the current government, it is not straightforward. Malawi is a country that is full of illiteracy, one. Two, elections in Malawi are not policy-based elections. They are based on tribe. So the tribal card, ethnicity, and regionalism plays a greater role in the way that Malawians vote political office bearers. Now, should the vice president decide to openly support the opposition, Malawi Congress Party, that would sway some people who are behind the vice president and vote for the Malawi Congress Party. But should he decide not to contest in the 2019 election and also decide to keep quiet on the political events, I think the game is very much open-ended. We cannot simply say that because the vice president has condemned the current government, therefore the opposition Malawi Congress Party is going to win the 2019 elections.
Will the power of incumbency be enough to ensure his re-election following what we see as the growing strength of the Malawi Congress Party, the MCP, in next year's election?
President Peter Mutharika is not a populist leader. He is an aristocrat and very elitist who does not closely or touch with the lives of the ordinary Malawians. So the incumbency advantage that the incumbent president has is only to the extent of using state structures, state systems, and state finances to finance his campaign. But in terms of his personal charisma, he's very distant from the majority ordinary electorate.
Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from the Rumphi district in Malawi. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has promised to reform internal systems of the ruling ZANU-PF party. This, he says, includes creating a new structure to run the affairs of the party full-time. Local media reports say the president also pleaded with lieutenants to project a new face of the ruling party. His remarks came after admitting to the party's central committee that there was rigging in the ZANU-PF's recent internal elections. Opposition and civil society groups have often accused the ZANU-PF of rigging national elections, an accusation the ruling party denies. For reaction, I reach Rejoice Ngwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst in the capital, Harare.
Well, basically, I'm not surprised because following the multiple situations where most primary elections were repeated, it is very clear that, as the leader of the party, he was not happy with the processes Some people argue that it was a way of protecting his cronies, but I strongly believe that ZANU-PF and its leader know and understand that ZANU-PF as a party does not have a tradition of integrity in conducting elections. It's very clear because he advised his party to repeat some of the provinces that had been plagued by rigging.
He promised to reform ZANU-PF's internal systems, including creating a new structure to run the affairs of the party full-time. Would he have the backing to do so, particularly looking at ZANU-PF's history?
Good question, because ZANU-PF naturally, at this stage, is plagued with factions. So it is almost impossible, because those that argue say when the G40 element was expelled, it was an elitist arrangement. The actual structural foundation of G40 that was created by individuals like Cesar Kasukwere is still intact. So it is very difficult for him to be able to restructure why he's also facing elections. So the elections are putting him under pressure to maintain some semblance of continuity without shaking the foundations. Because if he does that, he has to be completely prepared to lose out on the G40 vote. And I'm sure it's a risk that he can ill afford.
President Mnangagwa promised Zimbabweans of free, fair, credible elections. Recent polls show that Zimbabweans seem to have some confidence in the ability of the Electoral Commission. But do you see this internal poll rigging of the ZANU-PF elections spilling out into the open because of the track record of ZANU-PF following accusations that the party usually commit act of voter irregularities during elections?
Most researches and surveys that have been done so far, they show a fundamental structural deficiency in the way that ZANU-PF understands elections. So it is unlikely that given the history of insecurity within ZANU-PF, he can be able to do that. So I still believe that Mnangagwa does not have the capacity and the political will to endanger his political future by making any structural adjustments to the political processes. So it is within the DNA of ZANU-PF to cheat in the elections, and it's not going to change that.
Now, you've recently seen some polls that have come out ahead of the July general election. Some are saying Mnangagwa is popular enough to win, and because of the disunity and lack of supposed focus of the opposition, could pave the way for him to be generally elected as the legitimate president of Zimbabwe. What is your take on this analysis?
Well, if you listen carefully to Professor Jonathan Moyo, he has always been on the narrative that Emmerson Mnangagwa is unelectable. Now, we can dismiss him as a man who is suffering from sour grapes, but then understand that the original ZANU-PF that was committed to the Mugabe cause did not die with the coup. Mugabe supporters are still active, and they still have a capability of upsetting the ZANU-PF vote. So Mnangagwa's win is only dependent on the benevolence of ZANU-PF entity that believes in the Mugabe cause. But an outright win on his own political volition, I don't believe that is possible, because he is not a man who is very popular. He is not as charismatic as Mugabe was. And I strongly believe that there are ZANU-PF people that want him to lose the election to prove a point that Mugabe still has a following. So the closest that Mnangagwa can get is a runoff. And once there is a runoff, the opposition and those that believe in the Mugabe cause can sweep him off the board. So I believe that Mnangagwa cannot win a free and fair election only if he rakes in the support of compromised ZEC, the traditional leaders, and all the other institutions that tend to support ZANU-PF at this time of the political season.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. The Italian police have seized more than 10 tons of hashish stashed aboard a Dutch fishing boat and arrested its 9 crew members. The raid was part of an international anti-drug trafficking initiative. For VOA, Sabina Castelfranco has more from the Italian capital, Rome.
Italy's finance police boarded the Dutch-flagged fishing boat some 200 kilometers south of Sicily after tracking the vessel from the air for 2 days as it made its way through the Mediterranean. The boat had set sail from Malta and had met drug dealers arriving on speedboats off the coast of Morocco and Algeria. It was heading towards the Straits of Gibraltar. Finance Police Commander Stefano Soliuzzo said following careful examination of maritime traffic, the behavior of the Quest fishing vessel had appeared anomalous, in particular when it stopped for 2 hours off the coast of Morocco. Further suspicions, he said, led them to obtain permission from the Netherlands to stop the vessel. The commander said once on board, they found a large stash of drugs, more than 10 tons. Packages of different sizes were located in a refrigerator and a gas tank. The plan had been to unload the drugs off the coast of Libya. Finance Police Commander Francesco Mazzotta said the crew collaborated with police as they were quick to realize there was no way to escape. Officials said drugs recovered from the boat had a market value of more than $17 million. Italian authorities seized the drugs and confiscated the fishing vessel. Of the 9 crew members arrested, 2 of them, including the first officer, have been identified as members of a dangerous Maltese criminal organization. They had been arrested in Spain last year in a joint operation between the Italian finance police and Spanish police for trafficking 6,000 cases of contraband cigarettes. Another suspect was a Sicilian whose criminal record contains a previous conviction for armed robbery. The raid was part of an international anti-drug trafficking initiative in which Italy collaborates with a number of other European nations. Since 2014, Sicilian police have confiscated 7 ships and seized 130 tons of drugs worth upwards of $1.4 billion. The route used is always the same. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The Australian state of Victoria has taken the first official step towards signing a treaty with its Aboriginal peoples. It is the first time any Australian parliament has passed laws that commit to a future accord with Indigenous groups. For VOA, Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Aboriginal leaders hope a treaty with the state of Victoria will deliver political and economic benefits. The vote in state parliament is the first step in what could be a long process, but campaigners have said it was a watershed moment. The Northern Territory and Western Australia have also promised similar action towards their own treaties with Indigenous tribes. Critics have argued, however, that efforts should focus on a national Aboriginal accord rather than individual state agreements. But Pat Dodson, an Indigenous senator for Western Australia, is happy that progress is finally being made.
This is something we have to solve if we're going to have honour and integrity as a nation, as well as bring about justice and recognition and respect for the First Nations people.
Talk of treaties with Indigenous Australia isn't new. In 1988, former Australian Prime Minister Bob Hawke promised a treaty with the nation's original inhabitants.
There shall be a treaty negotiated between the Aboriginal people and the government on behalf of all the people of Australia.
But the former Prime Minister's promise wasn't fulfilled because of various concerns over the implications of an official accord, including financial compensation. Australia is the only Commonwealth country, a grouping of nations with ties to the former British Empire, that doesn't have a treaty with its original inhabitants. Canada and New Zealand have formal agreements with their Indigenous peoples that include compensation for past injustices as well as land and fishing rights. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of the country's population and suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment. Campaigners believe a formal treaty could provide practical help in areas such as health and education. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the United Nations is asking the international community to help millions of refugees and displaced people in Africa's Lake Chad Basin. The Boko Haram insurgency is mainly responsible for a crisis that has left huge numbers vulnerable to hunger, malnutrition and violence. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The Lake Chad Basin is into the ninth year of a humanitarian crisis that does not appear to be easing. The United Nations has appealed for $1.5 billion to provide life-saving aid for some 7.8 million people in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Though half of the year has gone by, only one-third of this urgently needed money has been received. The region's four UN humanitarian coordinators came to Geneva this week to brief member states about the emergency facing people in the area and to plead for them not to be neglected and forgotten. Humanitarian coordinator for Niger, Bintou Djibo, describes the suffering of civilians who lack protection and run many risks in this insecure, lawless region.
Millions of innocent women, children, and men are at risk of human rights violation, including kidnappings, killings, rape and sexual exploitation, and abuse. Across the region, people continue to be displaced from their homes, either due to conflict, food insecurity, or the effect of climate change.
The United Nations reports 2.4 million people remain displaced because of the nine-year-old Boko Haram insurgency. It says 5 million people are seriously short of food and require assistance. Djibo says malnutrition is widespread and life-threatening.
Children are always the most vulnerable in any humanitarian crisis. Nearly half of the million children under 5 years are suffering from severe acute malnutrition. Without treatment, they risk death.
Protection needs are particularly acute within Nigeria, where Boko Haram militants continue to wreak havoc with the population. The humanitarian coordinator for Nigeria, Edward Callan, tells VOA that Boko Haram is still very active, though it has changed its tactics, concentrating on suicide bombings instead of large-scale attacks.
Boko Haram is still a potent force. There's a lot of rhetoric that the war has been won, but the practical experience we have in the field is that it is becoming very much an asymmetrical warfare, and they are all scattered in small splinter groups, which makes them more potent and also very risky for international staff.
The UN humanitarian coordinator for Cameroon, Allegra Bolochi, says all countries in the Lake Chad Basin are affected in different degrees by this group.
All our countries have had several hundreds, if not thousands, of surrenderees. Boko Haram coming out, you know, and wanting to be given another option. And I think the countries have taken advantage of this in different ways. And I speak for Cameroon, and I think we're a bit late in trying to pull together a demobilization and a stabilization strategy. So that really remains a priority.
UN officials agree Boko Haram will not be defeated militarily. They say the root causes must be tackled, especially the poverty and lack of development in the four countries that have pushed many into joining the militant group. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The former Ghana Football Association president has been banned by FIFA from football activities for 90 days. Ghana has said it will dissolve its National Football Association after Kwesi Nyantakyi was filmed apparently accepting a cash gift. He was pictured taking $65,000 from an undercover reporter pretending to be a businessman. Mr. Nyantakyi is the second most powerful official in African football and also a member of the FIFA Council. Ghana Football Association announced on June 8th, hours after the ban was put in place, that Mr. Nyantakyi had stepped down as its president. FIFA could in theory ban Ghana from international competition if they deemed the move to dissolve the GFA to be political interference. Nyantakyi is the most important prominent member of more than 100 football officials, most of them West African referees, who were caught receiving cash. Among those caught on camera was Kenyan referee Adel Range Marwa, who was bound for the World Cup in Russia until he resigned after he was filmed being given $600. Marwa was the sole Kenyan among the 16 African officials designated for Russia and among 63 assistant referees set to officiate at the tournament scheduled for later this week. In another development, World Cup-bound Tunisia have lost ground to the latest FIFA rankings released just a week before the start of the world's biggest football competition. The Eagles of Carthage slipped from position 14 in May to position 21 currently. The North Africans are, however, still the best-ranked side on the continent, ahead of Senegal and the DR Congo. Guinea-Bissau is Africa's biggest loser, though, in the new rankings, losing ground to the tune of 17 positions from 104th to 121st. Rwanda also lost ground, sliding from 123rd to 136th. The biggest gainers from the continent were Madagascar and the Central African Republic. In the overall rankings, current world champions Germany retained their position at the top, ahead of Brazil and Belgium. Hosts Russia will enter their own World Cup as the lowest-ranked side of all 32 teams competing in the tournament. Russia had been ahead of Saudi Arabia when FIFA's previous standings were released in May, but have now slipped 4 places to 70th in the new rankings. And the official draw of the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup Uruguay 2018 was held on Wednesday at FIFA headquarters in Zurich. The groups that were confirmed are Group A has Uruguay, Ghana, New Zealand, and Finland, while Group B has CONCACAF 1, South Africa, Brazil, and Japan. Group C has CONCACAF 3, Cameroon, Korea DPR, and Germany. Group D has Korea Republic, Spain, CONCACAF 2, and Colombia. CONCACAF qualifiers will finish on June 12th. Ticket sales will go on sale on Monday, August 13th, with the first phase reserved exclusively for Visa card holders. Fans with Under-17 Women's World Cup tickets will be able to watch 2 games in the same stadium on the same day. Finally, Cameroon, Zimbabwe, and reigning champions Nigeria are all on the verge of qualifying for this year's Women's Africa Cup of Nations in Ghana. All three recorded their away wins in the first legs of their final round qualifying matches on Wednesday. The biggest winners were 2016 runners-up Cameroon, who beat Congo 5-0 in Brazzaville. Zimbabwe beat Zambia 1-0, and that was the same score for South Africa over Lesotho and Nigeria against the Gambia. Algeria and Kenya both won at home, while Ivory Coast were held to a 2-2 draw by visiting Mali. 8-time winners Nigeria earned a narrow 1-0 win in the Gambia, with the only goal of the game coming after 19 minutes from Okoronkwo Amarachi. A first-half goal from Rutendo Makore sealed the win for Zimbabwe in Lusaka over Zambia. The two meet again on Sunday in the deciding tie. South Africa's narrow 1-0 win over Lesotho came from a 9th-minute goal from Leandra Smeda, who scored with a curling shot. Kenya earned a 2-1 win over Equatorial Guinea, the only other team, apart from Nigeria, to have won the Continental Women's title. Algeria were the other winners on Wednesday with a comfortable 3-1 win over Ethiopia in Algiers. The seven overall winners of the seven ties will all qualify to join host Ghana at the Women's Africa Cup of Nations in November, and the top three from the Nations Cup will then qualify for next year's Women's World Cup in France. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent. But first, Leo Sarkisian, a retired broadcaster for Voice of America Radio and father of music time in Africa, has passed away. He died on Friday in Massachusetts following a short illness. He was 97. Leo was an ethnomusicologist who traveled across Africa recording indigenous music in many of the countries he visited. He will be sorely missed by the entire VOA family. This music collection is dedicated to the memory of Leo Sarkisian.
Waiting for this moment for so long, but me hope you understand. I've been trying not to make things go wrong, but I'm only just a man. So right now me left you for alien. Without you life is sweet like sugar cane. We meant to be like Jack and Jim, but right now me little in your eyes like liquor we in your.
At his best, hey, around the plan, she passed the test. Now I got more space in the closet for my best bets. If you think you'll be the one to make me cry,
no way, no way.
If you think you'll be the one to make me happy,
no,
no
way, no.
Oh,
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 since you're gone, yes, I'm doing fine.
Hey.
Oh, oh. Thought you left me for bad, but you left me for good. Please don't come back in my life, coming I mean to be rude. Thought you left me for bad, but you left me for good. Please don't come back in my life, coming I mean to be rude.
To me, girl, that makes me wanna be with you. Try the way you did do it, they make me the see. Say I want to be with you.
I just wanna give you the love.
I
just wanna give you good love, good touch, good taste. Every breath, come take, come close. You are my love, lean on my shoulder. But I told you, I'm just a lover, not a fighter. No cussing over, baby, come over, come over. Stay over. And I'll give anything, and I'll do anything. I'ma go down, go down, go down, go down. If you're down, I'm down, we are down, so go down. Now the way where you do me so, now the way you do me, yeah. See the way that you do what you do to me, girl, that makes me wanna be with you. Now the way you do me, they make me they feel so shaggy.
Yeah. That's a drone at your firm. Unfuni in a dama coma so. Girl, I wanna love you to the end of time. May your body cross us to kill my son. Yeah, so don't be surprised if I kill myself all in the name of love. Me and I may be pair, will let me pay the price. So I dream, you see me team, why I'm a fair with rough. Beauty lies in the eyes of beholder. Oh, home to girl, I'm sober. And kind of life, and I'm chasing my daughter when it's over. Since I'm irresponsible, me bomb mobile is a soldier. Jaina woman, kind of winning, brand new baby soldier.
And that was Sunday music dedicated to the memory of Liu Sarkisian here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Ever since the brutal overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi in October 2011, Libya remains in chaos. Those who had argued that Libya will reach something like a golden age with the removal of Gaddafi have been proven wrong. Regrettably, the greatest victim of the instability in Libya has been the Africans from sub-Saharan Africa who are emigrants in Libya or transiting Libya for a greener pasture in Europe. The United Nations has recognized a government in Libya, but that government does not have control over the entire territory of the country. There are pockets of resistance, and today it is believed there are four major military and political factions in Libya. The United Nations has appointed a representative of the Secretary General, and he has been using his best efforts to work out a settlement, but no major results have yet emerged. Last May, President Macron of France convened a conference in Libya, in Paris, to see whether these four major political and military factions could be reconciled, particularly on a common program that will look forward to elections in 2018. Although the conference was held with the attendance of the United Nations and also the African Union, nothing much has progressed since. The chaos still continues. One wonders whether the African Union will try to play a more assertive role in Libya. Of course, it is understandable if the African Union stays in the background, because prior to the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi, the African Union presented a well-prepared roadmap that could have helped the Libyan people to reconcile their conflict. But those major powers that they have their own interests in Libya encourage the parties to reject the African Union roadmap. And we now see the consequences. But it is time for the African Union to return to see what role it can play, because others are pursuing their own national interests, whereas the victims in Libya are the Africans. So this is a time not to overtake what the United Nations is doing, but to see whether they could play a major role alongside the United Nations to see whether peace could be pursued in Libya. It is not easy, But this shows also the folly of the policy of regime change. Yes, with major powers or military force or economic sanction, one can promote regime change. But then what? And Libya is today a classic example that it is not proper for major powers outside of the African continent to search for regime change. Quite often, regime change produces further chaos, and Libya is the example. So for the sake of those Africans who have been telling horror stories of their lives in Libya, one hopes that the African Union will see whether a more assertive role is called for at this time. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, do not let what you cannot do tear from your hands what you can. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On May 1st, the Syrian Democratic Forces initiated Operation Roundup, the eviction of the last remnants of ISIS from northeastern Syria. The first phase of the operation ended successfully in mid-May with the liberation of the town of Baghouz. The second phase of Operation Roundup, clearing the terrorists out of the town of Dashisha, began on June 3rd. We welcome the launch of operations by the Syrian Democratic Forces against ISIS terrorists in Dashisha, Syria, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a written statement. Dashisha is a notorious ISIS stronghold in northeast Syria, from which ISIS has terrorized the Syrian and Iraqi people for many years. Dashisha is just 50 kilometers from the Iraqi border, so Iraq is also involved in this process. The Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, too, is heavily engaged in support of the Syrian Democratic Forces. As the second phase began, it conducted numerous airstrikes and engagements against ISIS fighters and equipment. We will help ensure that the government of Iraq has the support it needs to fully secure its borders against ISIS and other terrorist threats, pursuant to a strategic framework agreement with Iraq. We will also work to ensure that all the diverse people of northeast Syria, including Arabs, Kurds, Christian, and Turkmen, have an appropriate say in defining the future of Syria, pursuant to the political process set forth in the UN Security Council Resolution 2254, said Secretary Pompeo. The fighting over the days ahead will be extremely difficult. We have full confidence in our partners, the Syrian Democratic Forces, and we are proud to work with them to rid Syria from the scourge of ISIS and help build a better future for all Syrians. President Trump has acknowledged that there is more work to be done to complete the defeat of ISIS, and he is committed to finishing the job as quickly as possible while setting the conditions that will prevent its return, he said. We continue to call on coalition members, our regional partners, and allies to share the burden for ongoing stabilization efforts that are critical to preserving the military gains that have been achieved.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.